to that case. We have counsel here.
Okay, sounds good. We'll get this set up in the background. Ms. Young and the other attorney, please stay on the call. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kwame. All right, so we are now hearing the case of United States versus Macapagal. I apologize in advance if I butchered that name. I rename people regularly. Counsel for appellant, please approach and proceed.
May it please the court, Max Mizono on behalf of the defendant Noel Macapagal.
Thank you.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Counsel, please be reminded that the time shown is your total time remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
This is not an easy case. No. I will concede that it involves talking about a reprehensible subject matter and crime of conviction. It's not a discussion to take lightly, nor is it a conviction to take lightly. But the difficult subject matter does not mean we should brush aside and ignore what actually happened at trial in this case, where the government argued to fit a square peg theory of prosecution into a round hole of a criminal statute. That's 18 United States Code Section 2422B, a statute that criminalizes online enticement. And that's the first issue that this appeal presents, which is the government argued an invalid theory of prosecution to the jury. The remedy is that a general verdict must be set aside when jurors are left with the option of relying on a legally inadequate theory to convict, and this court must remand to the district court for a new trial.
Counsel, is it your argument that no online media was used in this case?
No, that's not the argument, Your Honor. The argument as to it, the first issue on appeal is that the government treated this statute as a facilitation statute. It treated it as a statute where no online enticement occurred, but rather any enticement or attempted enticement of a minor would occur in person. So the persuading, inducing, coercing, or enticing did not happen online. The logistics to arrange this unlawful tryst did occur online. But the actual online enticement, the actual online grooming, what this statute prohibits did not happen online.
But aren't you parsing that a little too finely?
Well, Your Honor, I would just point the court to the government's opening, the government's closing, arguments had at the judgment of acquittal, the Rule 29 stage, and when I argued during my closing, the government's successful objection. So I'd just like to quote what specifically the government argued to illustrate how this theory of prosecution was completely invalid under this statute. Quote, in the opening, the defendant showed up at a house intending to persuade three young girls, aged 6, 9, and 11, to have sex with him. So intending to persuade in person. Not that he
has
on...
all after all the online conversations with the person pretending to be the mother of the children.
That's correct. There were online communications. There's
lots of them where he learned how old the children were, what they liked, their favorite colors, what he was going to do. How can you say that all, and it was, is your argument that because they were talking to an intermediary, that's irrelevant? I don't quite understand, because there is law the other way.
There is law the other way. So I understand the court's concern about the adult intermediary issue. I can get to that. That's part of the second and third issues on appeal. But with respect to what the government actually argued, again, I'll quote again. In closing, the government argues the defendant would have faced no consequence for walking away. What he was intending to do was persuade, induce, entice the children, and by going online, that's how he accomplished it. In other words,
that's a reference to online.
It is a reference to online.
So it appears that you want to just focus on the government's argument regarding when he actually showed up and disregard the government's references to the online contact.
That is not exactly what I'm arguing, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is that their only theory was that he wasn't attempting or would persuade, induce, coerce, entice the minors into having sex in person. And another part where that is evinced is the government argues in closing it's not his chats alone that makes him guilty. When I argued at the judgment of acquittal stage, I argued to the district court judge that the enticement must occur online, not in person. The government argued that it disagreed with that as a matter of law.
That was a confusing exchange. I give you that. I think the government acknowledged that. But it seems like a lot of the arguments you're making, or perhaps all of them, sort of depend on the assumption that the statute doesn't cover enticement through the mother. And that, I think, is the key question in the case. Obviously, every other court that's looked at this has seemingly gone against that view. But just looking at the statute, where do you get your position from, just off the text of the statute?
Is Your Honor's question in reference to the adult intermediary?
Yeah, exactly. Because I think that the whole case and much of your arguments about the evidence actually turn on that, because I think you're essentially operating on the assumption that that's not covered, and then the rest of this then sort of falls into place because you're arguing that there was a enticement in person. But I think the government would say, well, that what happened later in person was just indicative of his intent to commit this entire offense. But if you go back to the statutory text, which is what your client is on the hook for, where do you see in there that this the intermediary is not permissible?
So there's two arguments that we raised as far as the adult intermediary issue. And the first argument, I will concede, is not raised on the cleanest of slates, given that essentially all the other circuits who have addressed the adult intermediary with respect to this statute have sort of gone the other way. But that's not the full breadth of the argument. The second part of that argument is that the evidence remains insufficient because the government did not prove that any enticing was done through the adult intermediary to convey to a minor or to instruct.
I just don't understand that, because that the whole discussion online was setting up his coming to the place.
Sure. So
he was following through. It was a demonstration of what he was doing online, wasn't it?
I understand the court's question there, and I think the response is that we have to look at the actual backstory of what the government chose to set up in this case. So remember, it's the government, it's two FBI agents who are pretending to be this mother of three young children, right? That's undisputed. But what's also undisputed is that the government agents reached out to the defendant appellant here on a lawful adult forum website called DoubleList. The defendant appellant had a lawfully posted, advertisement to engage in adult dating, and it was the government agents who reached out to him and said, "Are you into taboo FF?" That was the first communication that they had.
You're not arguing entrapment, are you?
No, I'm not. That's not an issue on appeal. So that was
what was wrong with the agents reaching out to him?
I'm not saying that it was wrong for the agents to reach out to him. What I'm trying to convey is that that sort of colors the whole argument as to whether any persuasion, inducement, coercing, enticing was necessary occurred.
Some flavor of this in the briefs, essentially the fake children were already enticed. They were already sufficiently groomed. That seems like an argument that the jury could hear and perhaps credit, but also reject based on the facts.
Well, it goes to how the evidence was insufficient, because the government's brief addresses three different ways that this statute can be violated. First is if a defendant communicates directly with a minor. The government chose not to set up that scenario in this case. So they chose to set up an adult intermediary who had a relationship as a fictive mother with three fictive children. So the two other ways the government says that the statute can be violated is that there has to be some sort of conveyance to the minors of enticing remarks online, or that the defendant has to instruct the adult intermediary to groom those children in advance. And that didn't happen in either respect.
Wasn't there evidence that, in fact, the mother had conveyed some of the comments, that the daughter was psyched to have the defendant come over? Like, there was some, again, it was all hypothetical, but there was some communication back to the defendant of the mother saying, "Oh, I told the daughters about this, and this is what they want," and he knew that.
But the distinction, Your Honor, is that the defendant never told the adult intermediary to say, "Convey what I'm doing or I want to do online."
Wasn't that couldn't somebody draw that from the facts? Even if he didn't say specifically, "I want you to tell the daughters that I'm going to do X, Y, and Z," wasn't that part of the whole nature of this communication, was to have this discussion with the mother, to socialize some of these things with the daughters, to see if this was an arrangement that would work?
I mean, that's the government's argument. Our argument is that the defendant did not actively employ the adult intermediary to convey or to instruct. Number one, because he didn't say share anything with respect to what we're talking about online with your children. And secondly, he didn't instruct the adult intermediary to do anything.
Well, what was he doing with her then?
He was accepting the offer that they proposed to him with pre-groomed children in this scenario to engage in an unlawful tryst. That is not what this statute is meant to capture.
And she says, well, I want to prepare the girls for what you're going to do, and he says, well, we can take a shower. I don't want to go through all the
facts, sure,
but it's quite explicit when he says what he's going to do, and he's through her, he's communicating with the children.
It is explicit.
At least that's the inference a jury could draw.
It's explicit, and I also don't want to go through all that again. I had to go through it all at trial, so
yeah,
I would rather not do that again.
Is this at bottom just a sufficiency of the evidence argument? This is not a statutory interpretation argument. This is basically, let's look at what the evidence showed and ask whether somebody could conclude from that. And again, I'm trying to figure out how much of your argument depends on just saying that the intermediary is just categorically out. Because I think if the intermediary is categorically in, then this just becomes a question of the sufficiency of the evidence.
So that's not just our argument. And I concede that the adult intermediary issue has been decided the other way by multiple other courts. But that's not the only argument we raise. The sufficiency argument has to go with how they presented their case to the jury using the adult intermediary. And there was no conveyance or instructing to do anything because the minors were pre-groomed. The agents reached out and presented this scenario to the defendant. It was not like the multitude of cases, particularly the McCarran case, which this court recently decided earlier this year, whereby it was the defendant initiating communications. It was the defendant there that proposed a sexual rendezvous. It was the defendant there that said, this is what I'd like you adult intermediary to do prior to anything that happens in person. In other words, did online grooming. That did not occur here. So not only do we have the sufficiency argument, but we do have the invalid theory of prosecution that the government advanced time and time again from beginning to closing and also during the intermediary stages of this case, including when I closed and the court sustained the government's objection when I argued that this statute criminalizes online communications, specific activity, and the court sustained the government's objection for my misstatement of the law. I don't believe that's a misstatement of law. I think that's a proper statement of law. And that tainted the jury much in the same way that the government's invalid theory of prosecution did. The third argument, and I know I'm running a little short on time, so I'll try to save a little bit for rebuttal, but is that there were two erroneous jury instructions as well. So it's not just a sufficiency claim. The erroneous jury instructions had to do with the adult intermediary and the willing minor. And I want to focus more on the adult intermediary instruction. And it was erroneous because it failed to require proof that the defendant attempted to use the adult intermediary to get through the children. It also was erroneous because it merely required the defendant to make any type of communication to the adult intermediary that was not predatory in any way. So, for example, the adult intermediary instruction says this: the government's not required to prove that the defendant communicated directly with a person he believed to be a minor. The first element of the offense can be satisfied where the defendant communicated with an adult intermediary or adult guardian of a minor, as long as the defendant acted with the intent to persuade, induce, or entice. So the way that I'd like to, you know, set up a hypo as to how that could happen in real life is if I called my son's friend's father and said, hey, son's friend's father, I want to take your kid and my kid to the beach. I'm initiating a communication online, but while I'm harboring a subjective intent to persuade, induce, coerce, entice. I don't have to say, it doesn't say
it's
I have to say
that.
That's
the only way. The problem I have with your hypothetical is that that's not the only way the communication can go. That's one way, but not the only way.
But that's a fair reading of how this adult intermediary jury instruction could construe a conviction under this statute. So, you know, that jury instruction is clearly erroneous because it, in tandem with the willing minor instruction, which perhaps I'll save for rebuttal, I'm running short on time, but to get back to Your Honor's main point, sufficiency is not the lone argument we're raising. The invalid theory of prosecution, the erroneous jury instructions also constitute error that were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Rebecca Perlmutter representing the United States. Let me start in the bottom line here, and I think this is something that all of your honors pointed out in your questions to the appellant, that this case actually is not a close call. This case was about the online communications at bottom. The entire case was about the extensive chats and the online communications and the phone calls that this defendant had with the adult intermediary. And that's assuming that you accept that adult intermediary is covered within the scope of the statute.
Were there tapes of the phone conversations that were played?
Yes, and those audio tapes, yes, Your Honor, were submitted at trial.
And counsel, wasn't it the request of the defendant that they go offline and go to phone calls?
I can't remember. I was not trial counsel, so I can't remember exactly who suggested that they go offline to the phone calls, but I do know that there was at least two extensive phone calls. And both the phone calls and the chats themselves, you know, show what the defendant's intent was and show that these online communications were really the bread and butter and the heart of the case. And I guess that brings to three essential points here in rebuttal to the defendant's argument. The defendant really is the appellant's making a sufficiency argument, and I think that that's what really Judge Bress pointed out. But it's trying to make a clever pivot because the facts are so overwhelming here to categorize it more as a legal argument, and that's just false in two ways. One, the government's theory at trial was not that this was an online enticement case. And what the appellant is doing is looking at the substantial step, which the government focused on based on tailoring the facts to their theory of the case, which was his travel, which was his bringing the gifts. And there's more than enough case law. In fact, you know, every circuit that's considered this has considered that travel is considered could be considered a substantial step.
What's the government's theory of the case?
The government's theory is that in using the online communications, he intended to persuade, induce, and entice those children, and he took a substantial step to do so by traveling to the meet and bringing gifts to do that. And I think you could look to the government's summation in their rebuttal at 5 ER 897, and that's exactly what the government said. The trial counsel, in responding to the defendant's argument at closing, said, and the way he accomplished that crime was by going online, in his text messages and his emails, communicating with somebody that he believed was a mother who had control over these children, who was willing to help arrange this dynamic. And they came up with his name, special friend, Coach Kelvin, they talk about. They talk about the gifts that he was intending, he's going to bring for the kids, and his words. He talks about his special touches and how he's going to ease them into being with me. These are his words in communications and interstate commerce, and that is why he is charged with an attempt to commit this crime.
Do we have case law on what a substantial step is?
Yes, Your Honor. There's significant case law on this. I think if you want to look at the Ninth Circuit case, you can turn to Getsky or you can turn to Meek. And both in Getsky and Meek, the court said that travel could be a substantial step. Certainly it doesn't have to be. It could be something else. It could be the communications online. But it is one of the means. In Meek, the defendant actually traveled to the school. In Getsky, it was a mail communication in Montana, and so there wasn't travel, and the court just referred to other cases where travel could be a substantial step. I mean, I could list cases, Roman in the Sixth Circuit, where the defendant brought the child's favorite candy in order to, quote, break the ice. But I think what's relevant here in thinking about the ideas of substantial step and adult intermediary is the statute is quite broad in law. Now, that's not how the government argued it at trial, because the facts here were so overwhelming on the online communications, but the statute doesn't require online communications. There's nothing in the statute that says that. The statute doesn't require that everything occur online. The statute's focused on the intent of the defendant who uses an interstate facility. And so if Congress...
online or some other facility.
It could be some other way, and that is, I think, why you see substantial steps such as travel, you see the use of an adult intermediary who may be grooming the defendant offline, fall within the scope of the statute, because the purpose of the statute is that the defendant is a predator who wants to gain the assent of the children, and it's the defendant's intent that matters.
But you can't simply criminalize the communications themselves, so there has to be a substantial step. Is that the...
And that's a proof issue, Your Honor. I'd agree with that. And I think that's why you see cases really focused on online communications, because when you're talking about a defendant's subjective intent, you have to have some objective act to be able to prove what was in their head. And that gets tricky. And so really when a government's assessing what cases to bring and what facts to focus on, they're really looking at what objective acts would confirm what the defendant was thinking in his head.
Yeah, So in your view, the defendant is turning this upside down by saying the government was actually proving the person-to-person attempt to communicate rather than the online use of interstate commerce device.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And in fact, I think, you know, the appellant talked a bit about context of this case, and I think the context here is really important, because why did the prosecutor focus on what he was doing when he arrived at the house? And that's because this entire case was not about whether the defendant actually made those online communications. I think the appellant would agree that that was not disputed in this case. What was disputed was the defense theory that this was really just a fantasy, that the defendant never actually intended to persuade those children because he actually thought they were adults. And so what the prosecutor rightly was focused on is, how do you rebut that defense, and how do you actually prove that when he made those communications and that when he showed up at the house, throughout that time, the continuum, his intent was actually to persuade what he believed were real children. And that's why the prosecutor was so focused on the gifts and so focused on his words to rebut the role-playing defense, which was really focused on the intent, which is the point of the statute here, really, Your Honor. I want to address the idea that the jury instruction related to the adult intermediary, which was one of the points that the appellant brought up, was somehow insufficient or an incorrect statement of the law. And I think the jury instruction itself shows how it actually took great effort to be an accurate statement of the law. I mean, assuming that the adult intermediary, of course, is a viable way in order to be one means to violate the statute, the jury instruction regarding adult intermediary here took great pains to relate it back to element one, which is the critical part of the statute, that the defendant had the actus reus and actually acted with the intent to coerce, persuade. So it's what's actually in the defendant's mind in engaging with the adult intermediary, which the defendant did here.
Can I ask you just to switch gears to Special Condition 7?
Because yes.
I wanted to hear the government's perspective on that. We have a new case, United States v. Wells. Does that decision mean that this special condition is overbroad and needs to be tightened up?
I think in this particular case, I wouldn't agree with that, for a couple reasons. One, and I don't intend to say that this is the government's strongest argument here, but I do want to point out that the defendant in its brief, or the appellant, excuse me, I do see co-counsel in the trial setting, and so that is why I keep referring to him that way. But in the brief of the appellant on page 34, the appellant does admit that the objection in front of the trial court was an overbreadth objection. And Wells explicitly says it's not discussing overbreadth in its case, and it's actually talking about a vagueness challenge to the statute.
What's the difference?
I just pointed out that if it's a plain error review, if the court does slice it that far, that I can't say that it would be substantial necessarily or affect fairness in this particular case, and in part because Wells was focusing on a different statute. It was focusing on a collector of child pornography.
There was
somebody
an objection
who,
to Special Condition 7. Are you just saying it wasn't a good enough one?
I'm just pointing out the fact, Your Honor, that
it's a different one.
It's a different objection, and I think that the overbreadth objection is slightly different, and the idea tailored to this particular defendant in this case is actually quite a bit different than Wells, because this case involved internet communications online through the means of a computer. And if you actually look at 18 U.S.C. 1030, that definition coincides with the type of devices that you would use to engage in communications with a minor or somebody else. That's tied specifically to the defendant's conduct in this case. And so I do think there is a distinction that you could make in
Wells. Computer means device that's capable of communicating with another person, basically?
Yes, and I think so. And I think that that is tailored to the specific instance in this case and to the degree of harm that the defendant could cause. And certainly, if the defendant had a question here, if it's an overbreath issue, can ask can ask the probation officer. And the only other thing I want to point out about Condition 7 and how it relates to Wells is that there is Ninth Circuit case law. I think United States versus Ped is one of those cases that in viewing a supervised release condition, the court is supposed to construe that narrowly and to see if there's any construction of that condition that could be construed narrowly. Wells relied on an unpublished decision in discussing how it got to its reasoning where that attempt to construct narrowly was not viewed in that situation. And so the only point I make here is that in viewing a different statute that Wells did not consider, that under the facts of this case and the defendant's actions here, I think there is a view that you could narrowly construe this condition that would not make it overbroad.
Would you tell me again how you narrowly construe this so that it's not overbroad?
I think in using 18 U.S.C. 1030, I'm talking about computers or other communication devices, unlike something that wouldn't have the ability to actually connect or communicate with another person.
Doesn't that include an iPhone?
I think an iPhone would be covered. Yes, Your Honor.
But not a refrigerator or an exercise watch or something like that?
That doesn't seem reasonable. And certainly, if the defendant had questions about that, he could certainly go to the probation office, could seek a modification of the condition. But under these particular facts, that doesn't seem like a reasonable construction of it, particularly if it relates to the defendant's conduct and the extent of the defendant's conduct, where it's not just a possessory type charge, but it's actually a communication charge, and that's the harm that the condition was trying to get at.
So does that mean that the defendant has to call a probation officer before he calls his mother?
I think that, you know, the defendant would have to get approval to use his phone for purposes that are authorized. And I think that happens all the time in computer conditions. You can use your computer for authorized conditions, such as for work purposes, such as for contacting your family. And there are categorical exceptions. But that allows the probation office to at least monitor and understand and have a conversation with the defendant about...
I'm trying to get my head around this. I can understand approval to use the internet. I'm not quite sure I understand approval to make a phone call to a relative, right? Because it's the same device.
I guess, Your Honor, the computer condition versus the internet condition, they do coincide, yeah. You know, to a certain extent. I would agree with that, right? Because it's the means of using the computer. It's not the storage. So they're trying to get at the same purpose in different ways, I would suggest.
I think what you're saying is this is covering essentially communicative devices, things that allow you to talk to or text or email or somehow communicate with another person.
I think that that's a fair way to phrase it, Your Honor. Yes.
What would be wrong with remanding this back for the district court to take a more detailed look to see how this affects the defendant and to narrow it as opposed to us trying to envision how it can be narrowed?
Related to Condition 7 in particular?
Yes.
I think that would be up to Your Honors, and I do understand that the Wells case has made this a more difficult argument for the government. The only thing I point out is the statute itself is different, and the conduct is different than what Wells was trying to get at, but I do understand.
The concept is there. Yeah. That's the difficulty. The concept of Wells seems to translate to this condition.
And the government recognizes that. Certainly there could be a more tailored condition crafted, and I would acknowledge that. Unless there are any more questions, I see that my time is almost up.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. What's telling is that in the government's answering brief, they didn't even address the first issue in this case. Didn't even list it as an issue. They buried their response to that in the multitude of other arguments that they made. And, you know, essentially, and now they're arguing differently, I suppose, but that was not presented in their answering brief. I just want to point out to the court that there are a multitude of state and federal statutes that prohibit in-person underage sex with minors by adults. That's not what this statute criminalizes. this statute criminalizes online or the attempted online grooming of a minor. And the government's theory that just so long as the logistics and the communications occur over interstate commerce, whether by telephone or the internet or otherwise, and that there's an intent to do something in the future, persuade, induce, coerce, entice, in person, that's enough.
But in this case, there was evidence presented and argument made by the government that it was online.
There was, but there was also multiple times that they argued that this was an in-person facilitation type statute. Again, I've quoted multiple times in the opening where the government is saying that he's intending to do it in person, and he just merely used his cell phone and internet to arrange it.
But argument of counsel is not evidence. So we look at the evidence that was presented to the jury, and evidence presented to the jury was of online contact as well as personal contact.
Right. The government says that the theory of the defense was that he thought that these were adults, and that to rebut that, they emphasized that he showed up with bags full of candy and stuff. What was the theory of the defense? Do you disagree with that?
I disagree with that in part because that was not the entire theory of the defense. That was one defense that I submitted at trial, but there was two other defenses, one being entrapment, which is not an issue on appeal.
Right.
But the third defense was that the government did not prove that this statute was violated in the way that they say it was violated. There was no online grooming. The way that they proved their case was that the defendant went online, but not in his online communications did anything to evince an enticing remark to constitute online.
This is almost like an entrapment light argument to say he did not entice anybody because these people were already enticed by the mother. That was essentially the defense.
That's part of it. The other part is that there was no conveyance, there was no instructing to do that online because the scenario presented, cooked up by the government, was not that these minors needed any enticing. They were already pre-groomed, they already had experience. They could have chosen a scenario where the defendant communicated directly with the minor, or where the defendant communicated with the adult intermediary, and the adult intermediary said, my children are expressing reluctance. But that never happened. There was no reluctance. They were willing, and that's why the legal argument that they presented at trial is invalid, as well as the sufficiency of the argument evidence and our objections to the jury instruction.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You've exceeded your time. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. We will be in recess until 10:45.
All rise. This court stands in a 10-minute recess.
Hi, folks. Are you seeing me in the courtroom at this point, Mike?
Kwame, yes. This is Tony. We're all here.
Are you seeing me on the screen?
Yeah, you're moving.
I am moving. Great. Okay. Let's see here. Before you disconnect, let's just see if maybe the system's fixed itself. Ms. Olson, can you turn on your... Or Ms. Olson or Ms. Young, can you turn on your video?
I've turned on my video.
Okay, are you seeing Ms. Young on the screen?
Yes, correct, yeah. Yes, Kwame.
Okay, and if I turn mine off, are you still seeing Ms. Young on the screen?
Yeah, she's full screen now.
Okay, Ms. Olson, would you mind turning on your video? Let's just... make absolute certain that all of this is working if you're around. Thank you so much. And Ms. Young, if you can go ahead and stop your video for a moment. Okay, and you're seeing that change. Now you're just seeing Ms. Olson on the screen, nothing else?
Yes.
Okay, so whatever was going on appears to have stopped going on. I'm not sure what. Basically, it looks like... the image from my camera, which looks like this, and when I cover it up, I use that as a slate so that there's something on the screen. When I have that up like that, it looks like that image got frozen onto the video system. So we'll hope that doesn't happen again. Ms. Olson and Ms. Young, thank you so much for your patience. Sorry about this technical issue. Let's see here. I think they'll probably want to take things in order. So, Ms. Young, if you want to turn on your video when they come back, actually, if you want to turn it on now, that would be great so we can see and make sure that it's working and that we're not doing this all again. And I'll go ahead and stop my video. And we'll start streaming again when the judges come back in. And just verify, you are seeing Ms. Young on the screen now.
Yes.
Thank you. Great. I know you folks aren't by a microphone, so it's difficult to hear. All right. So I think we're ready to go. Let's not reconnect. If this is working, this is working. Let's. I think we're ready to go. Thank you. And I'll start streaming again when I hear the gavel. Thank you.
rise. This court for this session now resumes. Be seated.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. We hopefully have all technical glitches resolved. The next case on calendar for argument is United States versus Barogo. Counsel for appellant, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you see me okay now?
Yes, you're there.
Thank you. Okay. Catherine Young from the Federal Public Defender's Office. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and I will watch the clock.
All right, thank you.
I'm representing appellant Maritas Barogo, who is appealing her sentence and the amount of restitution awarded against her following her conviction for using SNAP benefits without authorization. Ms. Barogo owned a restaurant. She was not entitled to SNAP benefits. She entered into an agreement with her co-defendant that Barogo would pay her co-defendant Muna $400, and Muna would give Barogo her SNAP card and PIN, and Barogo would purchase $600 of food for her restaurant. Now, the total benefits that Barogo and Muna trafficked were recouped from Muna, so restitution was not an issue for most of the litigation. The government took the position that Barogo should pay half the amount of restitution, even though she had, in fact, reimbursed Muna for two-thirds of the restitution. Barogo agreed that she would pay half of the amount that she purchased from Muna, which was $15,000. The day before the restitution hearing, the government for the first time sought an additional $21,000 from other parties, JD and AM, and that's what's in dispute in this litigation. That amount of benefits and the basis of the calculation of those benefits varied from $5,000 to $21,000 over the few months of the proceedings. And it all started in the PSR. The PSR said that in December 2019, they saw photos of men delivering carrots to Ms. Barogo's restaurant. So they went back and looked at all the register receipts from two stores for those people's purchases. And they calculated in the PSR all the register receipts from those two stores from 2019 and 2018. No further investigation was done at that time. The next month, the supervisor of the public welfare investigator overseeing the investigation of the Investigation and Recovery Office testified that she was involved in the investigation. She confirmed the loss amount with Muna was $15,000, and with the others, the JD and AM chunk was $5,000. She set not the total of the $21,000 that was set forth in the PSR as being suspected, all purchases at two stores. She said that based upon their investigation, only $5,000 of that was trafficked with Barogo. She said that $20,000 was a fair assessment of the total amount from Muna and JD and AM.
So
they had done an investigation.
There were a lot of different proceedings here, but eventually it culminated in testimony by, I'm not sure I'll pronounce his name correctly, but Mr. Karadang, about the receipts. The receipts were for bulk,
right.
bulk purchases. The defendant had acknowledged that she had trafficked in SNAP benefits with these two people, JD and AM. And so it was a matter of calculating it up, and they went through the receipts, and they saw that these are items that are not typical for household use because they're high-volume food items that were consistent with use in a restaurant. And there's other evidence, like the videos and the photographs, that add some more credence to that. So when you add that all together, I guess the question is, where's the error, and particularly given the relatively deferential standard of review for this kind of determination by a district judge?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because the first point you were making was that they had gone through the receipts, and that's exactly what didn't happen. That's what Karen Dang testified to. But the reason I'm going back to the beginning is to point out that his testimony was baseless, that he didn't, in fact, do what he said he was doing, and that his testimony was contradicted not only by his own supervisor's previous testimony, but also by the PSR and also by his own testimony in other respects. He was contradicting everything. And the reason I went back to the beginning was to point out that when you get to his testimony, he says, well, I've gone through the receipts, but he didn't. Because the PSR tells us that the exact amount that Karen Dang found was the total amount at two different stores. Nobody went through the receipts and tallied them at that point. The total amount at two stores is what the PSR said. And then Ms. Borgia testified that we've done an investigation. We've narrowed it down to 5,000. The government then brings in Karen Dang, doesn't bring in Borgia, doesn't mention Borgia, Karen Dang says, I've gone through the receipts, and I've arrived at the same amount that was the total amount of purchase at two stores. So he couldn't have done that. And we know that by all other aspects of his testimony. When he says that, for example, he said, first of all, it's the total amount at two stores, at one store, maybe more stores, other stores, big stores too. He's all over the place. But the important thing is that he's arriving at the exact same amount. The PSR says is, we haven't done our investigation yet. These are suspected amounts because they're the total purchases at two stores. Karen Dang then takes the stand and said, well, it's one store, it's two stores, it's more stores, it's big stores, but I've gone through all the receipts. But he couldn't have, because the amount he's relying on is the amount the PSR tells us is the very beginning amount of total purchases at two stores.
Can I ask you,
and there are other respects in which Karen Dang's testimony demonstrates that it can't be credible. First of all, he says... I'm sorry.
I don't want to cut you off, but I did, just with your limited time, I did want to hear from you on the authentication feature issue and why you believe that enhancement wasn't proper. So I'd welcome you to finish your comments on the restitution, but I just wanted you to know I'd like to hear your views on that other issue too.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Since Mr. Barroco has been released, the restitution issue is the most important issue to her now. I did want to just close out by, and I will get to the authentication feature, but I just wanted to point out, as it's discussed in the brief, Karen Dang's testimony is not only internally contradictory. He says things that are all over the map. It also contradicts his own supervisor's testimony and the PSR. But let me turn to the issue that Your Honor wanted me to raise, and that's the authentication feature enhancement. And in this case, it's important to note that Muna gave Barroco her EBT card. She gave Barroco the pins. There's no issue of – it's a genuine EBT card and a genuine pin. No issue of fake IDs. And the government tells us that to interpret statutory language, we look at the language itself, we look at the specific context of the language, and we look at the broader context of the statute as a whole. So if we look at that enhancement, which is 2B1.1B11, subparagraph A analogizes or equivalences the possession or use of a device-making equipment or an authentication feature. In other words, they're saying it's the same thing to have device-making equipment or an authentication feature. So they're and the whole paragraph is talking about the production or trafficking of false IDs. It's talking about the possession of five or more false IDs, the unauthorized transfer using false IDs to make other false IDs, production and trafficking. None of it's all false IDs and production of trafficking therein. In this case, we have a genuine PIN and a genuine EBT card used with Muna's authorization, obviously used illegally, but with the authorization of the holder. There's nothing fake about the IDs or the PINs in this case. So that's why we have trouble applying and why we argue that the enhancement simply doesn't apply to this case. Now, under the terms of the language, the enhancement applies only when an authentication feature is used on an identification document, document-making implement, or means of identification to determine whether the document is authentic or falsified. And in this case, the PIN wasn't on the document, and it wasn't used to make sure the EBT card was genuine. So it wasn't used as an anti-counterfeiting measure on a physical identification document. And that, because of the language of the statute or the guideline, the focus of the guideline and the facts of this case, we're arguing it simply doesn't apply. And I see that my time is low, so are there any other questions that I can address on these issues?
Counsel, this is Judge Schroeder. Can I just ask you briefly, what precisely is the relief that you're asking for?
Well, we'd like to be reversed for reconsideration of... the restitution. That's the main thing. We think that it was clear the district court's restitution finding was clearly erroneous. We also think that the enhancement should be reversed, but at this point it's moot since she's already served her sentence. But the restitution is the main issue that she would like reconsidered.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Ben Petersburg for the United States. May it please the Court. There are three issues raised on appeal, and we would ask the Court to affirm on all three. The first issue is that the government did breach the plea agreement below when it asked for 2 years of supervised release, when the plea agreement itself, in the plea agreement, the government promised to recommend 1 year. Yeah. But we would argue that The appellant has still failed to show a reasonable probability that that breach affected the outcome of the sentencing. Second, as to the authentication feature, we argue that there's no plain error. And third, that the restitution order was supported by sufficient evidence and related factual findings were not clearly erroneous. The first issue was not addressed during the initial argument, but I think it is important, and that's where I wanted to start. We do concede that there was error there, and unfortunately, that error was mine. I was counsel below. I made an inadvertent and sort of careless mistake. I was very careful when I recommended a sentence of imprisonment at the low end of the guidelines. I was not as careful when I recommended 2 years of supervised release instead of one. That said, there was no objection below, so we are not in automatic reversal territory. The appellant does still need to show a reasonable probability that that breach affected the outcome of the proceedings. And when we look at that recommendation in context, I think it shows that there was plenty of support for the court's decision ultimately to impose 3 years of supervised release. The government asked for 2 years in a written sentencing memorandum that was filed on May 28th of 2021. The U.S. Probation Office also asked for 2 years of supervised release in its written recommendation, which was filed 2 days prior to that, May 26, 2021. At the sentencing hearing itself, the government repeated its recommendation. Probation asked for 1 year of supervised release. The defendant asked for 3 years of probation initially and then a split sentence. So after two sentencing hearings, briefing and argument on sentences imposed on similarly situated defendants, the defendant's allocution and the court's thoughtful consideration of the aggravating factors supporting her sentence, she really went into great detail in ER 93 to 96, taking particular issue with the defendant's conduct and her continued unlawful behavior engaging in this SNAP trafficking even after she was approached by public health investigators in the case. The court actually called her a scofflaw in the sentencing transcript. So there's plenty of basis to support the ultimate imposition of 3 years of supervised release. And under these facts, we can submit that we can only speculate whether the court would have imposed a lesser term had the government actually recommended 1 year. And so we would ask the court to affirm on that issue. Of course, if the court disagrees and finds error that is sufficient to vacate the sentence, it can still does still have the discretion to consider the remaining issues on appeal. And the second issue that I'd like to address is the authentication feature. And I do want to note for the record that they did not object to the application of this enhancement in the pre-sentence report. They did not object to the application of the enhancements at sentencing. And in fact, they stipulated and agreed as part of the plea agreement that this application applies to her offense conduct. So based on that stipulation, there was really not a great need for additional evidence or testimony supporting its application, and the relevant portions of the record are somewhat limited.
Well, your adversary just said that this is moot because she served the sentence. Are there collateral consequences to the enhancement or?
Not that I'm aware of. It is an issue that could come up in other cases, so if the court does choose to address this here, I don't believe there's any other cases addressing whether or not a PIN, a personal identification number, constitutes an authentication feature. If the issue has been abandoned, good for us, I suppose. At this juncture,
it doesn't make any difference.
It is what
I'm hearing.
Well, ultimately, if
you'd like to have a lovely opinion saying that this was fine,
it would be useful for us.
It doesn't happen to affect this. It's not going to affect this defendant.
Understood, Your Honor. If the court has questions on that particular issue, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'll move on to restitution. We do submit that the restitution order was supported by sufficient evidence and that the court's factual findings below are not clearly erroneous. The district court was familiar with the facts of this case, presided over two sentencing hearings and a restitution hearing, and personally observed the testimony of the public health investigator, Ruben Carandang, and found him, quote, very credible when it determined the restitution amount and imposed that restitution order. Despite the claims that there are internal inconsistencies, there are facts in the record that clearly support the court's findings. And those are found in the PSR at CSD 9 that total up the
What did Carradine do? He or someone at his direction reviewed various transactions, and did they make any attempt to isolate out particular items that they viewed as likely to be SNAP benefit items that were going to the restaurant?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what Mr. Carradine did, and that was his testimony at the restitution.
How did he do that? Did he personally do that? Did he have somebody do it on his behalf?
He testified that he personally reviewed those receipts, all of the records of the purchases made by the people identified as JD and AM, all the purchases made using their SNAP accounts from 2018 through 2020.
And were there items that were charged to the SNAP accounts that he, in his judgment, decided those were not likely to go to the restaurant, something that seemed like it was more for personal use?
I don't know that he testified to that specifically, but he did say he identified large transactions that were consistent with household use, and that he looked for items that also coincided with the types of food that was served at this restaurant. He actually, at one point, identified the purchase of a whole pig and was able to link that up with a Facebook post by Ms. Barogo displaying a whole roasted pig.
What is this issue with the $5,000? Was that earlier in the proceedings, that reference to that amount?
That was earlier. That was at a sentencing hearing. And Bernice Borja, she's actually the supervisor at Public Health, she testified in support of the government's recommendation at that time, which was 10 months imprisonment, and we asked for a $20,000 fine. And so she was testifying for a different purpose. At that point, we had asked for a fine because there were administrative proceedings in effect to recoup some of these SNAP benefits from the beneficiaries themselves, and we were concerned about double recovery. And so a recommendation was made for a $20,000 fine, which we knew was roughly what she would be liable for if there was an order of restitution in her own case. The court declined our invitation to impose a fine and asked us to proceed on the restitution issue, and that's why we had the hearing a few months later. So I don't think there are actually inconsistencies in the amount that we were looking for. We asked for a $20,000 fine as an approximation of restitution, and the actual restitution order was $18,752.30. I hope that answers the question. In sum, the government's brief did point out to specific facts supporting the court's restitution determination. They're not inconsistent. The testimony at the restitution hearing is not inconsistent with the PSR. It was in addition to the information included in the PSR. I don't read that as conflicting in the same way that counsel on the other side did. If you look at CSD 9, paragraph 29, where there's a total amount of the SNAP purchases identified, it actually says it's based on the register receipts obtained from stores. So it's not this sort of arbitrary figure that was sort of referred to in the initial argument. The court below, we think, correctly made this determination based largely on the testimony of Mr. Carradine and the PSR. She found Mr. Carradine very credible, so we would submit that these factual findings are not clearly erroneous and the restitution order should be affirmed. I see I do have just a little bit of time remaining. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions from the court.
It appears there are none. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal.
Ms. Young, just before
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Young, are you abandoning the authentication feature issue? Is that an issue we need to resolve, or there's some other collateral consequences for your client, as Judge Schroeder was asking?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize because I may have misspoken. I was focused on restitution, which is obviously the most important thing to my client, but she also is concerned about the supervised release. And that authentication feature issue could have an impact on supervised release because there is, I think, authority that if a defendant overserves her time in custody, the court can consider that and possibly reduce supervised release. And so the supervised release, the extent of supervised release, is obviously something Ms. Barogo is also concerned about. Have I responded to that question?
Well, just to be clear, I mean, this was raised as an assignment of error on appeal, and the time has been served, and so I think the court, all of us are asking, do we need to resolve this? And it's your client, so what is your view on that?
Well, my view is that it could be relevant. If it's found that enhancement was inappropriate, then her guideline range would be lower. That would mean that on retrial or resentencing, it could be argued that she should be entitled to a lower term of supervision because she had overserved the term of custody.
Okay. Thank you.
That's what I'm arguing. And I also wanted to respond to the government's argument about how it's not the PSR is not inconsistent with Karen Dank's testimony, and it is necessarily inconsistent. If you look at the PSR, what it says is they're talking about the total receipts at two stores. That amount is the total receipts at two stores. Karen Dank then takes the stand and says, that's the amount of receipts that I've gone through maybe one, maybe two, maybe many stores, maybe big stores, and I've gone through all these receipts and arrived at exactly the same amount. So they are necessarily inconsistent, and we'd argue that because of all the other flaws with Karen Dank's testimony, it should be rejected. Unless there's any further questions, I see I'm out of time now.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The next case on calendar for argument is United States versus Santos. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sharon Rancourt, and I represent the appellant in this case. May it please the court, I'm respectfully asking for 3 minutes at this time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, counsel. Please watch your time.
Your Honors, the issue on this appeal is straightforward. We're asking that this court vacate and remand back to the district court judge because the court abused its discretion by failing to explain its reasons for rejecting Mr. Santos's non-frivolous arguments. Simply put, we can't tell what, if any, legal standard that the court applied. The court's tercery reference to the government's lack of support, and I believe it's just one line in a minute order, this doesn't suffice as an explanation. And if it's interpreted as a blanket rule denying the motion simply because the government objected, then that's the wrong legal standard.
I guess one question is, I mean, if you felt it was uncertain what the district court had ruled, couldn't you have gone back to the district court and filed a motion or asked for clarification?
That is an option to go back. We didn't do that. We're also permitted to take a direct appeal, and that's what we chose to do in this particular case. But yes, it is correct that we could have gone back and asked for clarification, but we're not required to do so, and therefore we did not. We chose to take it.
Counsel, was the judge who denied the motion the same judge who presided over the case?
Yes, it is. Now, I was not the same attorney who worked on the case, and our office, from what I can tell, was not the office that worked on the case. But I went back and I did read the pre-sentence report, and I went back and read the transcripts that were available for the sentencing, and it was, in fact, the same judge.
Yeah, so our cases sometimes say if you can look at the record, if it's the same judge, you can discern the reasoning of the judge. Is that possible in this case? If we look back over the entire proceedings and get a sense of how the judge viewed this case and the seriousness of the offense, why can't we then say that based on what the judge has said previously in the record on this case that we can discern the thinking of the judge in this case?
It's correct. There is a reference that the court can go back and look at the entire record of the case, mm-hmm. and that's brought up in the Emmett case when it talked about the record and whether or not the court can go back and look at the record. And in this case, no, we can't discern. And we can't discern because not only are we looking at the record from the sentencing some 10-odd years ago, but now we have a record that encompasses updated characteristics, updated circumstances of the individual. I believe even an updated judiciary policy because Monograph 109.
Why wouldn't we read the district court's order as saying, I basically agree with the reasons that the government has stated? It could have been drafted in that way, but why wouldn't we read it that way?
First of all, that's not exactly what it says. It says the government's response does not support defendant's motion for early termination of supervised release is denied. It's possible that the court denied it simply because the government didn't support it, and if the court did that, that's an inappropriate application of a blanket rule that this court...
Well, it could just be describing what the government's position was and by inference agreeing with it.
But which part of the government's position? The government's position that said, oh, 33 months is just a blip in supervised release given the history of substance abuse, or the government's position that said, Mr. Santos doesn't deserve to have early termination because of what his conduct was at the time.
Does it matter which one?
convince the judge? Does that matter?
It does matter. It does matter, Your Honor, because when we're looking at the supervised release statute under 3583, it tells you to look at the applicable 3553A factors. Mm-hmm. And one of those factors that's excluded specifically is punishment. And when the government says something in its briefing that Mr. Santos doesn't deserve because of what he did in the past, that's akin to saying we need to keep punishing him. We need to punish him by leaving him on supervised release, mm-hmm. because we don't like the fact that he challenged the safety valve application, or we don't like the fact that he asked for an evidentiary hearing at sentencing. And going back to the sentencing, even though Mr. Santos did those things, the court didn't give him an obstruction of justice. The court permitted Mr. Santos to stay out on pretrial release conditions pending trial, to stay out after sentencing, and even to turn himself in afterwards. So notwithstanding Mr. Santos exercising what I'm presuming were his rights at sentencing, the court didn't make a specific finding that he was in danger because of any of those things.
No, the court gave him some breaks, but when the government says that he hasn't accepted responsibility, he hasn't been truthful, he has a long record of substance abuse, and it seems fairly obvious what the government, nature of the government's opposition was, and this judge was familiar with the record. I don't see how we can infer that there was an improper reason, or that those weren't the reasons, or that those are not good reasons.
Well, I think if we go back to the Emmett case, and Emmett spells out that Emmett requires a duty to explain the decision. That didn't happen here. We could guess, but we don't know which part, if any.
No, we don't, but our cases also say we can look at the record, and if we can discern from the record the reason that the district court made the ruling. And, you know, as Judge Schroeder pointed out, this judge was not a judge who had it in for this defendant. She carefully weighed everything, and so it's hard to believe that she didn't continue to do that. But what I wanted to ask you is, realistically, do you think if we sent this back, the outcome would change?
It did in Ponce, which is very interesting, because in Ponce it got sent back.
In this case, with this judge, with these facts, with this defendant, do you think the outcome would change?
I believe it could, had there been a hearing, had she been able to see Mr. Santos. I believe it
could. Well, there's no requirement for a hearing, so it's not realistic to say that if we sent it back, there would be a hearing.
Well, I believe that if we did go back and the court were instructed, or it were suggested to the court that the court needed to follow the guidance in Emmett, which was, again, kind of elaborated on a bit in Concepcion, which talked about indicating that the court reasoned through the arguments, because that's also lacking in this case. There's no indication that the court reasoned through the particular arguments of counsel, especially of defense counsel in this case, or of the probation officer in this case. And I believe this court may very well do that. I believe if it goes back to the court and there's given a chance to reflect. And if we look at this case, the timing of it was a little bit interesting, because the government's opposition came in on a Friday. I believe February 4th was a Friday. And by Monday morning, I don't know if it was Monday morning, but by Monday, the minute order came out denying it. And maybe there was a whole good deal of reflection that happened prior to that decision coming out, but the timing was quite quick in this particular case.
Or maybe the court was so familiar with the case and the circumstances that it didn't take a long time. Oftentimes when you've been the judge on a case for a substantial period of time, you already know the background facts. It doesn't take a lot of rumination to get to the bottom line.
I think that when we look at what's on the record again, I draw this court to looking at the up-to-date circumstances, which is pertinent to the history and characteristics at the time that we're making the motion. We look at that when we do compassionate release motions, and we can look at that when we're doing a motion for early termination. The court didn't do that here. And
well, we don't know. I mean, are you saying that the court didn't read the papers?
I can't tell from the decision. How much reflection was that? I do want to accord that to the judge. I do want to respect the judge, and yes, I do want...
I really don't think we want to tell the judge that you got the papers on Friday and you decided it on Monday and you should have decided it on Tuesday.
I'm not trying to say that. But I am saying that there's nothing in this minute order that indicates that there was a real meaningful reflection and consideration of all arguments.
She took into account the positions of all of the parties. It was clear that she had read the papers.
But then if one considers the position of the government relied on an improper legal standard because the government did talk about a blanket rule of nothing exceptional. There's the Ponce case, which talked about that. The government did refer to he doesn't deserve it. And we also have the guides to judiciary policy, which encourage a presumption after 18 months. So we'd submit that this should get sent back, have the court do the reflection contemplated by Emmett, and I'll reserve what little bit I have left.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Olson for the United States. Good morning. I'd like to just jump into the discussion and note here, it's very significant that the district court judge here asked for the submissions, specifically requested the submissions from the government and from probation office. And that the fact that both the judge asked for it and the fact that the government and probation did submit briefing on this particular issue is distinguishes this case from Emmett. And that's a very, very significant difference from Emmett. In the Emmett case, which is also the Ninth Circuit, the court did not receive submissions from probation or from the government. And so in this case, there's much more opportunity for meaningful appellate review because there are those substantive submissions which the court did not have in Emmett.
Counsel, you have to agree that there is not much explanation in the order as to why the court made the ruling that it made.
That's correct, Your Honor. The court, EO simply states that, notes that the submissions from the government and probation office were made and that the government opposed. There's no reason to assume, as the court suggested, that the judge asked for these submissions and then simply did not review them. And as the court noted, the Ninth Circuit has repeatedly, both in Cardi and in Emmett, stated that an adequate explanation in some cases can be inferred from the record as a whole. And this is that case. This is more akin to Cardi, where in Cardi, the court stated that the complexity of the record below is also highly relevant, as well as how experienced the judge is who's involved. And this is a very simple case. As the court pointed out, this is the district court judge below was a senior judge who had been on the federal bench for decades. This judge has handled countless sentencing hearings, sentencing issues, and has also handled this particular defendant's case for over a decade. She knows this defendant well. She knows how defendants of this sort fare under supervised release programs. The information was filed in this case in 2011. The same judge accepted his guilty plea in 2011. She handled his original sentencing. She reviewed his PSR. She approved the very supervised release conditions at issue here. She handled an evidentiary hearing related to sentencing issues and safety valve. And this same judge herself found at the end of that evidentiary hearing that this same defendant had not been fully forthcoming with the government about his involvement in this same drug conspiracy. This same judge also reviewed and denied the defendant's motion to reduce his sentence in 2016. And so this case, the judge here is the expert on these issues. The judge gathered all of the appropriate facts and arguments from all of the different sides, from the defense, from the government, from probation, and there's no reason whatsoever to believe that this experienced judge just did not consider them. And a district court judge does not take marching orders from either the defense or the government. There's no reason to speculate that just because there's not a lengthy explanation that the judge simply took the position of the government. That's not what the EO says.
Yes, but counsel, the question is whether or not we can adequately review what the district court decided.
I think in here, yes, Your Honors, and I think here, again, it's distinguished from Emmett because there are the multiple submissions from all sides. And in Cardi, this court in Cardi stated that there the judge reviewed the papers and the papers discussed the applicability of the 3553A factors. Therefore, we take it that the judge considered the relevant factors. That's a quote from the Ninth Circuit Cardi case, where we assume that the judge did apply the correct legal standard, considered the factors. And here, also in Cardi, a significant point is that the court noted the complexity of the case matters. And this is a very simple case. The court knew well that this defendant had not been fully forthcoming with the government, that this defendant had used meth, admittedly, every day for 17 years, and that contributed to his participation in the drug trafficking here. So it's a simple case with a very experienced judge who knew the record, knew the defendant, and so I think here we can, this is a case. In Emmett, the court said, that there is no blanket rule that an explanation must come from the bench. The court said there must be an explanation, but that explanation can be inferred from the record as a whole. And I think in Cardi, when you pair it with Cardi, where Cardi talks about the simplicity of the case, that's what you have here, a very simple case with a judge who is experienced and knows the record. The record is very complete, unlike in Emmett. And this is also a guideline sentencing, a supervised release range. It was 5 years, and that is the guideline range for this offense. And so I think that that's also relevant. And as the court discussed in Cardi, the fact that it was within the guideline range also mattered to the court in Cardi. And this is within the guideline range here. I'd like to quickly address what the defense said about that the government stated there was a requirement that the defendant's case be remarkable. That's not correct. The government did not state that there's a blanket rule or legal standard that the defendant cannot get a reduced or early termination of supervised release unless he has a remarkable case. The government simply said this is not a remarkable case, which is perfectly appropriate, correct. And there's also no reason to guess that the district court judge applied sort of an incorrect standard on that point. I agree with the court's suggestion that here, if it were remanded, there would be likely no change in the outcome, again, because we know the court is very experienced. We can assume the court did apply the correct legal standard, the proper factors. The court had a full record. So I think here we can discern the reasoning of the judge. And this is one of those cases.
I think we understand your position.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything in closing, counsel?
No, thank you, Your Honors. The government submits that the district court judge's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you very much. To quote from part of Emmett, the court said, in each case, however, an explanation must be sufficiently detailed to permit meaningful appellate review, and it must state the court's reasons for rejecting non-frivolous arguments. In this particular case, the court did not state any reasons for rejecting the multiple non-frivolous arguments that were raised by the defense, including, for example, the up-to-date characteristics of Mr. Santos, the arguments that were pointed out and echoed in the probation officer's memo, the arguments concerning the guide to judiciary policy, the arguments concerning his compliance over the years and with his drug testing while on supervised release,
and that simply didn't happen here, and that's why it violates Emmett. And in regards to the degree of explanation, Emmett is also very important, because when Emmett talks about the duty to explain and the meaningful appellate review, it goes further than some of the other circuits do. There is a footnote in Emmett that talks about how other circuits reach conflicting results, and it talks about other circuits that just give one point, one line, one remark, and that's not enough. And Emmett said, no, here we need to go further, and that's the abuse of discretion. To get to whether or not it would make a difference, that doesn't change the fact that there is an abuse of discretion that happened, and that's what we're asking this court to look at.
Right. Thank you, counsel. We understand your position. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The final case on calendar for argument today is Soda Home Sales and Leasing versus BYD Motors.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Christian Adams appearing on behalf of Appellant BYD Motors. With the Court's permission, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for any necessary rebuttal.
All right.
This appeal involves claims by a motor vehicle distributor against a manufacturer for statutory damages under the Hawaii Motor Vehicle Industry Licensing Act, or HMVILA, as it's referred to throughout this case. None of the findings and conclusions by the district court regarding liability are contested on this appeal. Our appeal only raises issues of statutory interpretation regarding the district court's award of statutory damages under the relevant statute, HRS 437-58G. I'd like to use my time to focus on three main points here today, first of which is statutory damages under HRS 437-58G do not apply to an ineffective termination or attempt to terminate the franchise. The district court in this case awarded Soda Home Sales and Leasing, or SSLI, statutory damages of approximately $1.3 million under HRS 437-58G for its capital investment in the franchise. The district court calculated this amount by taking SSLI's total income from its 17 other franchises in 2018 and 2019 and apportioning that amount to the 7 months during which the court found BYD, my client, the appellant, to have acted in bad faith. The language of HRS 437-58G makes it clear that statutory damages only apply upon, quote, the termination, discontinuation, cancellation, or failure to renew the franchise agreement by a manufacturer or distributor without good cause and good faith.
So, counsel, are you making the argument that the court did not find bad faith on the part of BYD?
No, not at all, Your Honor. I'm making the argument that there was no termination of the, there was no bad faith termination of the franchise agreement. The court made three separate findings that I think are very important to this argument. There was an initial attempted termination of the agreement, which occurred in September of 2018. There was the actual termination of the agreement that occurred in January 20th, 2021. Unrelated to both of those, there was a period of bad faith where my client did not respond to communications from the other side, and that was from August 22nd, 2018, through February 28th.
As I read your position, that you're saying that may be a breach of the contract, it's just not the type of breach that gives rise to the statutory damages.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. So again, we are not challenging that finding. We understand that's what the court found, that that was that period of bad faith. However, the statute does not...
I just want to understand your argument. So you're saying even though there was bad faith, there was not bad faith in conjunction with the termination of the franchise?
Correct. For the first initial attempted termination of the franchise, that was rescinded.
Because there was no termination.
Right. The court specifically found that it was rescinded and there was no termination, so that certainly couldn't have been part of that finding. the ultimate termination of the franchise, which again occurred not until January 20th, 2021.
But there ultimately was a termination.
Agreed, and that was found to be no bad faith attached to it, was not in bad faith, was not a challenge, was not challenged, and was not appealed. The ultimate termination. That was not part of the bad faith finding or any of the conduct that
came. That's because for that one, your client followed the Hawaii procedures.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. They followed it to a T. It was not challenged. It could have been challenged before the agency. It could have been challenged before the court. It was not. That was not challenged at all. That finding is before this court, unchallenged and unappealed. So the real question before this court, and just to be clear, Your Honor, there was a finding of bad faith for our lack of response to SSLI.
You stopped dealing with SSLI.
Agreed. And so and during this period, there was a period of bad faith. However, our key point is that the statute does not provide for statutory damages if they are not related to a bad faith.
But how is it not related, though? If there's an entire course of conduct that culminates in a termination, why isn't that entire course of conduct part of the termination?
Because it wasn't related to the termination at all.
Wasn't it just a discontinuation of the of dealings or of the contract within?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
Why wasn't a discontinuation of the contract if they stopped responding, stopped doing anything under it?
Because it wasn't, Your Honor. The district court specifically found that the contract remained in effect and in place through the ultimate termination. We had obligations under it, and they had obligations under it. For example, we could not then go and find another dealer. We could not sell any other vehicles in the state of Hawaii. We were bound to that contract. That contract remained in effect through the valid.
What is a discontinuation of a contract under the statute then?
Finality. Finality. It's very clear from the statute that, again, the precise language is the termination, discontinuation, cancellation, or failure to renew the franchise agreement or the contract. Tied to those, which I'll get to in my next point, is to support that, the statute also provides how you determine the fair market value or how you determine the valuation under the statute when a discontinuation, termination, cancellation, or failure to renew happens, and it is related to your notice to terminate or the day before or the date of termination or the day before the notice, whichever is greater for the franchisee.
You're saying they could not have obtained statutory damages. Could they have obtained some other damages? Contractual damages.
Absolutely, and the court said as much. The court said as much. So for anything short of an actual termination in bad faith, they are entitled to their actual damages. The court found as much. We're not challenging that. They didn't prove that at trial. They didn't prove any actual damages at all related to the bad faith conduct related to the agreement. So that is our point. We're not saying that this isn't us parsing the statute and parsing words and saying they weren't entitled to anything. Anything short of an actual termination in bad faith, which would have entitled them to statutory damages, entitles them to actual damages. They didn't prove any. They didn't prove any actual damages at trial. Had they proven any actual damages at trial, we would be on the hook for that. That is very clear. And so we are not trying to say that they wouldn't have any relief whatsoever. They would have your standard common law damages. And that is the precise purpose of this statute is 437.58G provides this provision for statutory damages connected. Yes, Your Honor.
I was going to ask a question. Would you agree that the district court concluded that SSLI was entitled to statutory damages premised on BYD's unsuccessful attempt to terminate the agreement during the period from August 22, 2018 to February 28, 2019? Do you agree that that was the district court's finding?
No. Yes, we agree that.
Is that what the district court found?
Yes.
First, okay. So why was that not consistent with the statute?
Because the agreement remained in effect and the agreement had not been terminated. So the statute specifically provides there must be an actual termination or end to the relationship to entitle them to statutory damages. If that is done, the statute then says there are two dates.
Okay. So you're saying that it was not consistent with the statute for the court to rely on the unsuccessful attempt as a basis to award bad faith damages.
That is correct, Your Honor. It has to be an actual termination.
I'm just trying to understand your argument.
It has to be an actual termination in accordance with the law. Well, then,
if it's in accordance with the law, how can it be bad faith?
No. It has to be an actual termination in bad faith. Had the court determined that the original termination affected a termination of the agreement in bad faith, they're entitled to statutory damages. Had the court determined that the ultimate termination was in bad faith, they would have been entitled to statutory damages.
But what I'm not understanding is what the district court was talking about, what was going on in between, which was that, as I understand it, the relationship just ceased. And that was what the district court was concerned about.
The district court found that there was, again, a period from August 22nd, 2018 to February 28th, 2019, where my client was not responsive to the franchisee and therefore was found to be in bad faith. Coupled with that, the court also found that the franchise agreement continued on. It continued on well past that. So
within that, I'm just looking at the timeline here. There was a period where your client said, we intend to terminate that. The other side said, well, wait a minute, you can't do that without following the procedures. And then fairly quickly, your client said, okay, we're not doing that. And then you eventually proceeded to follow the procedures that were required.
But you said, we're not terminating, but then you stopped dealing with them, right? Isn't that essentially what happened?
From a very high standpoint, yes, Your Honor. I think both sides stopped dealing with each other. So again,
why isn't that a discontinuation? Regardless of how the district court characterizes it, if we don't accept that characterization and say that's a discontinuation, what's wrong with that conclusion?
What is wrong with the conclusion that it was a
discontinuation of the contract?
Again, our position is that that is inconsistent with the statute. The statute makes clear, if you read the statute as to discontinuation, termination, end of the contract, it specifically relates to an end of the relationship and end of the agreement. The district court found that specifically not to be the case.
But I'm saying we are not bound by the district court's finding on that. We can disagree because that's an interpretation of the statute, which we reviewed de novo. So if we disagree with the district court's position that contract continued, then do you lose on this point?
No. Well, if the court makes that determination, I understand they're entitled to do that. No.
But if we do,
let
me ask. I'm trying to figure out what your position is. If we disagree with the district court and we say that the bad faith conduct resulted in a discontinuation of the contract, do you lose?
No. We do not lose this appeal, Your Honor, because at that point, if the court were to determine that, you would have to move on to damages. And the damage portion requires them to, again, per the statute.
That's a different issue. The issue is whether at that point they would be entitled to statutory damages under the law. And then you would move to whether or not the damages were properly calculated.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is correct, Your Honor. And again,
why don't you address that?
I'm going over, so I will touch on this very briefly. And this matter has been extensively briefed by both sides, so I will try to be brief. The way that the district court fashioned this is they took the total income or total revenue from the franchise unrelated to my client's franchise. So 18 total franchises, my client's franchise was basically worthless. There was, you know, they had.
But when you talk about a franchise, you're talking about the franchise for different brands of cars, is that?
The buses, mainly buses. We're discussing mainly buses here. There's some vans and some other, but you know, 18 different lines of vehicles, let's just call it. My client's buses, that franchise was worthless. They never sold a single bus. They incurred $300,000 in costs. Costs grossly outweighed, you know, no sales throughout the entire thing, essentially. So that, you know, no value to it whatsoever. The court took the value of the other 17 businesses and the income from that, unrelated to my client, and apportioned that over the court's determined time of bad faith. You know, that is completely inconsistent with the statute and is not permitted under any circumstances. The statute clearly says you pick one of two dates and you value the going value of the business, and those are your damages. I think what the point I just made is not in dispute. The statute says the going value of the business at one of those
two
dates.
That depends on what your definition of business is. Is the business the only franchise at issue, or is the business all of the franchises? So that kind of begs the question.
And that is my exact point, Your Honor, and that is what we briefed. So interpretation, common sense interpretation of the statute and practicality of that, our position is the business is, of course, our business, because that's what...
Well, what case supports that argument, the argument that in computing statutory damages, the definition of business is the business... The sole business that's at issue, and not the entire business of the company. What case supports that theory?
The basic statutory interpretation cases that we've cited, Your Honor, there is no case on point that defines that.
Right, and that's the crucial issue. What is business? What's the definition of business?
And again, that is absolutely correct, Your Honor, and I certainly understand where the court is coming from. Our point on that is the other businesses were very profitable, so our business. My client's business was operating at a deficit, was meaningless, was worthless. The other businesses were highly profitable, had been profitable before, were profitable after, actually more profitable.
What's our standard of review on that in reviewing how the district court defined business? What's our standard review?
I think the application interpretation of the statute, I think, is the legal side is de novo. The specific findings on the factual side, I think, is
from a damages perspective. I mean, why would it make sense to give the plaintiff this big dollar amount that's the full value of their business?
It makes no sense, Your Honor, and that is our entire point: is that you are calculating the money they've already earned on other businesses unrelated to us, and then holding that as damages against us.
I mean, the statute says for the dealer's capital investment, which shall include the going value of the business. Which you would think would fairly imply that particular franchise relationship and not everything else they might be doing.
That is exactly our point, Your Honor. That's what we've briefed.
Is this statute unique to Hawaii, or is this a general state?
No, it is unique to Hawaii. There are other statutes around the country that are companion statutes, but it is very unique to Hawaii, particularly given geography and how we operate as business. So it is unique to Hawaii, but there are other companion statutes out there. Very briefly, if I can touch on my third point, I will be very brief. The final point, so again, first point, our termination and what the definition of that is. Second point, what business is being referred to in the statute and what that is. I think we've covered all that. The third point is the district court also awarded the purchase price for various SUVs and a forklift that were provided by my client. This has been fully briefed, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it is very clear that the purchase price is not permitted by the statute. There is a vehicle to recover those costs, but it is the fair market value, again, on set dates. No evidence was presented during the trial on the fair market value. That was never determined. Instead, they were given the purchase price. That is not permitted by the statute, and that is very clear just based on the pure language of the statute. So, again, that has been fully briefed. I will leave that with the court, and with what little time I have remaining, unless there are any other questions, I will reserve it for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, Jeffrey Miller for plaintiff, appellee and cross-appellants, Sutter Home Sales and Leasing, Inc. The court focused on a very important point, and that is the dispute that the parties have over what is discontinuation. The BYD takes the position that if you take all four of those acts of a manufacturer that are taken in bad faith, that they all mean that the entire agreement had to have terminated. So but one of those terms is continuation. And continuation is not temporal. If they were to say that the contract had to be terminated, then it would make the phrase continuation superfluous.
So was there a termination here?
There was a termination late in the agreement.
Right, but in the relevant time we're talking about, was the discontinuation a termination?
No, it wasn't. It was a discontinuation. The district court found that. What the district court found was that from this period, from August 22nd, 2018 to February 28, 2019, that BYD had acted in bad faith by denying Soderholm its rights under this contract, and that the contract was still in full force and effect.
Right. See, this is, I think, the problem I'm having with your argument is that in a general sense, we might think of the word discontinuing as covering what happened here. But when you look at the way that this term is used in the statute, you have all these words, termination, discontinuation, cancellation, and then they're later shorthanded with the word termination. Right, we look at this, and it goes on to say we'll calculate it as of the effective date of the termination, right? And so, and that's just one example. That's in subsection G, but there's other examples that use termination. And so, it does seem to me that when you look at this, it's talking about discontinuation in a more formal sense of ending the agreement, which is obviously not what happened here because the district court found the agreement remained in place.
And our position would be that that is misinterpreting the statute because there would be no reason to put the term discontinuation as one of these four factors if it was required that the contract be terminated.
That's the whole bad faith problem, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Isn't that the whole bad faith issue? The contract was still, they were legally bound, but they stopped performing it.
Correct, and so it, to
so that's a discontinuation.
Yeah, I think it would turn the statute on its head because if you were required to have a permanent termination of the agreement, then in order and acting in bad faith in order to recover statutory damages, a manufacturer could easily avoid all that, like it did here, where it rescinded its termination and then said, "Fine, we're just not going to talk to you anymore. We're not going to give you any more information. We're not going to tell you updated pricing. We're not going to give you any statistics on vehicles." We're going to ghost you, basically. They refuse to ever communicate with Soderholm again.
But under statutory interpretation, each word must have a meaning. Otherwise, there's no reason for the word to be in the statute.
Correct. And that's our point, is that why put the word continuation or discontinuation in there if the prior word was termination? Mm-hmm. And they're saying it has to be a termination. So that it not only misconstrues the statute, but it would turn the whole purpose of the statute on its head when the statute is intended to, in part, prevent the overreaching of mainland manufacturers on local dealers. And that's exactly what occurred here, where they basically just said, well, we're not going to terminate you. We're just going to never talk to you again.
Because they had tried to terminate before and did it wrongly.
They did it incorrectly. We sent them a letter saying it's all incorrect. They sent us an email back saying, fine, we'll send you a new one shortly. But they didn't. Instead, they just stopped communicating with the dealer for ever again until in late December of 2021 or 2020, they did another termination letter. And this was literally a month before trial. They sent another termination letter that didn't even become effective until a few days after the trial. But at that point, what the district court found was, in essence, they had discontinued the agreement by its bad faith conduct, and the court recognized that. They said this was bad faith conduct during this term, while at the same time recognizing that the contract was still in full force and effect until that second termination right before trial.
Could we move to the issue of statutory damages and what the definition of business is and why the district court appropriately calculated damages based on the value of the overall business?
Yes, happy to, Your Honor. You had pointed to it before, what is the standard of review for damages, which is the calculation of damages is clearly erroneous and not supported by facts. As to the actual statutory damage, that is likely, the statutory term would be de novo, and we recognize that. The statute provides the damages when they have been found in bad faith, and the remedy, the damages, are to be calculated by the going value of the business. And our position is that the district court correctly determined the going value of the business by determining what, by looking to the evidence that BYD's expert itself had admitted into evidence, and that was the Soderholm tax returns during the relevant period of time. The district court was not excessive and was very restricted in its damage calculation by only looking at that specific period of time that it deemed BYD to be in bad faith. And it took
counsel, let me ask you this. Are you saying that the district court looked at the experts, the testimony from both experts, which included the entire business as opposed to the single franchise? Did both experts include the amount or the value of the business as a whole as opposed to the single franchise?
The our expert, whom the court declined to rely on, looked at the value of the business as well as the future potential value.
When you say business, does that mean all of the franchises or just the...
Yes, the business as a whole.
Okay, and the other expert, what did the other expert...
Well, he didn't render an opinion on what the business value was. All he did was try to poke holes in our expert's report, but as part of doing that, what was admitted into evidence was Soderholm's tax returns for the relevant period of time that they were in bad faith. The district court used that evidence to fashion its own damages calculation.
Well, I'm just trying to get to how we review this. So in order for us to say that the district court improperly calculated the damages, we'd have to say the district court erred in relying on the evidence that was admitted at trial from the expert.
Yes, but that's not completely my point. My point is that the court actually reasonably relied on those experts' reports.
That's my point, is that in order for us to disagree with the district court, we'd have to say that the district court was unreasonable in relying on that expert opinion.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm a little confused. As to the your expert put in the tax returns?
No.
No.
Pardon me.
Who did? Go ahead.
It was actually BYD's expert. They submitted, and as part of his expert report, was the tax returns.
For your client.
For my client.
And that included the whole income of the business, the
correct.
Entire business, all the franchise.
Correct.
And what did you put in?
Our expert, who is a CPA with over 25 years of experience, went through your traditional business valuation analysis of going through all of their records and all of their inventory. That's how they came up with the out-of-pocket figures to calculate what the inventory was worth, and fashioned what the going value of the business was. Based on the AICPA standards.
Was there an objection to that evidence?
No, there was not. And so it was competing. The objection, in a sense, was that BYD's expert, Mr. Todd, said, no, you've done it wrong. You applied 5% instead of 3% for estimated appreciation, things of that sort. So they were basically trying to say that our expert's report shouldn't be relied upon. And then what the district court did was said, I'm not going to rely on that. There's a simpler way to do it. I'm going to do it myself using the exhibits that were attached to BYD's expert report, which was Soderholm's tax returns.
So was there evidence, was the district court, the argument that is made here is that the business should be just the value of this particular BYD franchise, which is... not worth much. But,
correct.
Was that argument made to the district court?
During trial?
No, they argued in their briefs. I do not believe it came out. The trial was very accentuated because we were in the middle of COVID, and so basically each side submitted trial briefs and written testimony.
It was expedited?
Yes, expedited. And I do believe that BYD said that you should only look at the business of them selling BYD vehicles. And our position, to the contrary, was one that's too restrictive of a definition of business under the statute, and secondly, it would basically allow BYD to profit from its bad faith, because here it prevented Soderholm from selling its buses and then turning around and saying, you didn't suffer any statutory damages because we prevented you from selling our buses, so you had zero damages.
And I take it that in going into this relationship in the first place, BYD was looking at the Soderholm business in total and its track record and all of that stuff.
Absolutely. That's why they were basically they entered into the contract, because Soderholm is a successful bus dealer in the state of Hawaii and the South Pacific, and they wanted their brand represented in Hawaii, and they knew that they needed a licensed dealer to sell these buses in the state, so they entered into a contract with Soderholm to do that, and the two parties for the first couple of years actually worked together, and Soderholm introduced BYD's sales representative, all of his clients, and they were pitching the sale of buses, and then BYD soured on the agreement and tried to terminate it. Then they rescinded that because they realized it was not a statutorily proper termination.
Well, but your client wasn't selling any buses, I take it.
They had not sold a bus, because it takes a matter of years to sell a bus, and you either privately or through the public procurement process. If there's no more questions, I just wanted to briefly touch on another matter that BYD had mentioned.
Well, I have a question.
Oh, sure.
About the purchase price for the SUVs and the forklift.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to get to. The out-of-pocket damages. I think it's very clear that under the law, and I cited the Kanazawa case and others, that for out-of-pocket damages, you calculate them at the time of the purchase of the item. And it's only if it's in a restitution phase that you actually would go and try and in equity align the value that the purchaser received for that vehicle, so you would depreciate it. And I've cited three different cases in our brief that touch on that, and it's pretty clear. And one of them was a decision that the district court judge had opined on. So I think that's very clear.
So you're saying you don't calculate the depreciation of the items?
No, not for out-of-pocket damages. Those are compensatory damages, and so you just look at the cost of the purchase, at the time of the purchase.
How do you deal with the language says the dealer's capital investment, and it goes on to talk about value of the business, goodwill, as of the effective date of the termination. So why wouldn't we ask for the value at the effective date of the termination, whatever that date was?
Because both under these cases, even if you look at Strategic Diversity versus Alchemex, it quotes, when comparing out-of-pocket and rescissionary damages, the fundamental distinctions are these. One, out-of-pocket damages accept the transaction is completed, whereas rescissionary damages attempt to undo it. And two, out-of-pocket damage are measured by reference to the value of the property at the date of the transaction, while rescissionary damages, in order to approximate the undoing of the transaction, take into account the value of the property and any income produced by it after the date of the contract. So the district court looked at that and said, that's the correct date because it's a compensatory damage. If I can move on quickly, we filed a cross-appeal in case the court didn't agree with our positions on the main appeal. And I just wanted to briefly touch on the main point was that it's our position that the district court incorrectly limited the time of the bad faith conduct by BYD. The district court said that it went from no later than August 22nd, 2018, but that it ended in February 28, 2029, when Soderholm filed its initial complaint in this action. And the court didn't say why. And
2019.
February 28, 2019.
I thought that was when the agreement was properly terminated.
No, the agreement wasn't terminated. The notice of termination was December 17th, 2020, 2 years later. So the district court came up with this theory, well, it's implied because it didn't specifically state that the bad faith ended on February 28th, 2029, which the date Soder Home filed was...
2019.
I'm sorry, 2029. I apologize.
We're not quite there yet.
And we're presuming it because that was the date of filing the complaint. But the court made specific findings that were contrary to that. The court held that in other parts, we'll get there, it held...
What's our standard of review on this point?
Again, it would be abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous.
Clearly,
because it's a calculation of damages. Yeah. But my point was that the court picked that date, it also said that it found that BYD did not had no contact with Soder Home after that point, and furthermore that it could be implied that the court believed that Soder Home gave up on its rights under the contract, that it wasn't sending any more of these letters that it had been doing by email, letter, phone call every month saying, hey, talk to us, and never getting a response. But the complaint itself has which the court recognized in its findings of fact, had a claim for injunction to prevent BYD from wrongfully terminating the contract. It was also in the prayer of the complaint and the First Amended complaint. So the Soder Home was still standing on its rights, and the court actually recognized that. The Soder Home was still attempting to assert its rights under that contract, but
why,
BYD
why
refused.
Was it clear error for the district court to conclude at that point that Soder Home was no longer exercising its rights under the contract but had turned to litigation, and therefore the damages under the contract should end at that point? Why was that clearly erroneous?
Because the court definitely recognized that Soder Home was still standing on its rights, and instead of sending emails saying, please talk to me, without any effect, it filed suit to enjoin this bad
faith.
Right,
but it moved to a different forum for that. And so why was it clear error for the district court to recognize that it was no longer a contractual dispute, but now it had become a litigation dispute, and therefore the contractual remedies should end at that point? Why was that clear error for the district court to make that call?
Because the court should have recognized that Soder Home was still asserting its contractual rights under the contract in the litigation, just as it had been by sending BYD emails saying, you need to talk to us, you need to provide us information.
You can walk and chew gum. You could both go to court and
yes, but in court you were asserting the same position that you were acting in bad faith by not dealing with us while we have a valid contract, and I want the court to order you to.
But that was no longer a purely contractual remedy at that point. You're asking for damages under the law and not just remedy under the contract, and so. Why couldn't the district court say, at this point, we've segued from contractual remedies to legal remedies?
Well, in the complaint, in the First Amendment complaint, we asserted both.
I understand that, but why couldn't the district court, without being clearly erroneous, choose one path as opposed to the other path?
Suppose the court did.
Right, and why was that? I'm asking you.
Right.
You're saying that was clearly erroneous, and I'm asking you, why was that clearly erroneous? I understand that you wanted the court to keep both avenues, but why was it clearly erroneous for the district court to select one?
Our position is that it's inconsistent with the district court's acknowledgement that we were seeking an injunction and standing on the rights of the agreement,
understood.
Even through litigation.
Understood. We understand your argument.
Okay.
All right. Rebuttal.
Very, very briefly, Your Honors. I will touch on a few things that my co-counsel or my opposing counsel brought up. This idea that I think we've started to discuss of constructive termination, or there was somehow something short of a termination that resulted in the agreement
being discontinued. I understand the court's position on this. I just want to be clear, that was never anything.
We don't have a position. We're just trying to figure out what the law is.
I understand the court's questioning regarding that. That just to be clear, that was never alleged in the complaint. That was never tried. That was never the actual allegations and what was tried was actual bad faith termination. So there was some discussion of construction.
Actual bad faith attempted termination?
There was, yes, actual bad faith attempted termination and that resulted in actual termination. The district court found specifically otherwise. I won't get into that again, but as to the three different instances of the attempted termination and the actual termination and bad faith in between. But just to be clear, that issue was never before the court below. There was no factual determination that there was some sort of constructive.
It's a legal issue, actually.
Yeah. Understood, Your Honor. I'm just saying that those issues were not before the court below and were never tried and were brought up for the first time in the reply brief here today. On the damages, Your Honor asked as far as the valuation and what the experts gave.
I'm sorry to go back to it. I just need to follow up with one thing you just said. Your position is that the district court didn't actually make a determination as to whether there was a sort of de facto discontinuation based on the party's course of dealing. You're saying what the district court determined was that the attempted termination was itself an act of bad faith. Is that the position you're trying to
The district court found that the period of bad faith when BYD was not responsive to Soderholm was the bad faith. That was the bad faith, is the non-responsiveness. During that period, there was the attempted termination, which was rescinded. The district court found specifically that was rescinded and of no legal consequence. That's the court's finding on that.
Not a termination.
Right.
Not a termination, no legal consequence.
That doesn't mean it's not a discontinuation, though.
Understood, Your Honor. And then the district court specifically found that there was a actual termination that occurred later on that did not include bad faith and was not challenged and was not appealed. With respect to the valuation, BYD's expert did opine on valuation and opined that it was zero. That was before the court and the district court considered that as far as rejecting Soderholm's expert testimony as to valuation. I want to make that very clear, and I think there was some question as to what the valuation that BYD's expert did offer to the court, and that was confirming just what this court asked. That was the valuation of all of the franchises put together. There was no valuation offered.
But are you saying the district court could not rely on that as the valuation?
No, I'm saying, to clarify the issue, I'm saying there were two valuations offered with respect to the BYD franchise. Our expert offered zero. That was, I don't know if that was accepted or not. That is in the testimony that was there. Soderholm's expert offered that the value of the BYD franchise was $8 million. That was rejected and not considered by the court and considered speculative. So those were the only two figures given to the actual BYD business, setting aside the argument as to what business.
For the damages calculation, did the expert opine on the value of the business with all of the franchises?
No, the expert merely stated what was in the record, which is was Soderholm's tax returns and what they made on all of the businesses put together, which was that $2 million figure.
Thank you. All right, thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments in this challenging case. That completes our calendar for today. We once again thank the students from Hawaii Pacific and their professor for coming. Our law clerks will be available for the students to talk with after we have adjourned, if you would like to do that. With that, we are adjourned until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Bearing in mind that the law clerks can't discuss the cases that you've just heard.
Exactly. Thank you for that caveat. We are in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. Honolulu time.
All right. This court for this session stands adjourned.